Welcome to the 15th episode of Onc Live On Air. I'm your host today, Angelica Welch. Onc Live On Air is a podcast from Onc Live, a news source that provides oncology professionals with the resources and information they need to provide the best patient care. In both digital and print formats, Onc Live covers every angle of oncology practice, from new technology to treatment advances to important regulatory decisions. The European Society of Medical Oncology hosted their annual congress from October 19th to 23rd in Munich, Germany. Onc Live was on the floor at ESMO interviewing experts and writing articles, capturing insight from the biggest data being presented. Some of the most exciting findings to come out of this year's congress was in genitourinary malignancies. In bladder cancer, Jonathan Rosenberg, MD, a medical oncologist and chief of the GU Medical Oncology Service at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, reflected on the data he presented from the CheckMate 032 study. Extended follow-up from this study showed a trend toward overall response rate and longer progression-free survival with a regimen of nivolumab at 1 mg per kg plus ipilimumab at 3 mg per kg in patients with platinum-pretreated metastatic urothelial carcinoma.
Previously, the data from nivolumab single agent and the NIVO-3-IPI-1 had been presented, as well as a small cohort of patients treated with NIVO-1-IPI-3. And that small cohort showed a response rate that was about 38% compared to about 26% for both the other nivolumab or the lower dosed IPI regimen. So based on that early data, they expanded this cohort to include 92 patients rather than 26 patients. And in the 92 patients, found that the objective response rate was in fact 38%. So mimicked the smaller cohort, included the smaller cohort. The toxicities were not that different than IPI-1, NIVO-3, or NIVO-3. There was a bit excess GI toxicity, which you might expect, a little bit higher liver toxicity, but otherwise manageable. And the rates were not sky high, but were definitely increased. The overall survival and the progression-free survival were numerically longer with the NIVO-1 IPI-3 than either NIVO-3 alone or the NIVO-3 IPI-1. So the combination with the higher dose of ipilimumab looks like it has not only a higher response rate, but a numerically longer progression-free survival and overall survival. These are not randomized cohorts. They were sequentially enrolled. And so it's a little difficult to make the comparisons across them, but they give us some idea of the trends that you might expect to see.
There were also compelling results presented in prostate cancer. Of note were the subgroup analysis of the STAMPEDE trial, which showed that radiotherapy to the prostate improves overall survival in men with newly diagnosed and metastatic prostate cancer who have a low metastatic disease burden. At the Congress, Benjamin Mon, MD, PharmD, an instructor in the Division of Medical Oncology at Huntsman Cancer Institute, reflected on the potential impact of these recent prostate cancer data.
Well, so, you know, as an extension of that discussion from the STAMPEDE group, I would say a couple of things that are coming down the pike is, first of all, validation of these results in the surgery setting. I think that's really important. That will substantially change how we think about and treat a large volume of men with metastatic prostate cancer. And not only, you saw hints of it at that presentation, not only will it change what we do in that setting, but it will really open this whole new avenue of treatment of oligometastases as well, right? So not only should we treat the prostate, but what about intensive therapy with systemic treatment plus, you know, metastasis-directed therapy, you know, with radiation or surgery? So it's really going to start breaking up the field even more, instead of right now where we think about it as hormone-sensitive and castration-resistant, and everyone's in one bucket until you progress on ADT, and then everyone's in the next bucket. It's really going to start subdividing this into different subgroups based on biology, which I think is really fascinating. In addition, there's a couple of other trials that are coming looking at even more intensified therapy. So right now the standard is dual treatment with, you know, chemotherapy or ADT or novel hormonal therapy plus ADT. But now there's a couple of trials that are just about done with the enrollment, and so we should be seeing the readout in those in the next year or so, looking at triple therapy, looking at chemotherapy, novel hormonal therapy, and ADT, really doubling down on the intensified treatment approach.
So with all of this intensification, is there any concern for toxicity or like a worsening safety profile for patients?
Yeah, great question. So with the dual hormonal therapies, really there wasn't that much concern for increased toxicity. But now once we start looking at triple therapies, I think that really becomes much more of a concern, particularly in the realm of quality of life and fatigue. And I think that's, you know, because chemotherapy, ADT, and novel hormone therapies all cause fatigue. And the reason that that's particularly important, I think, in our patients is that we've seen validated now from the ERA-223 data that bone fractures are a real and significant problem for these men, especially now that they're living longer. And if we intensify their therapy to get better disease control, but do that at an expense of their overall quality of life, we're significantly impacting how active they are and therefore increasing their risk for osteoporotic bone fractures, which, again, we can see from that data is a very significant morbidity event for many of these men.
Arguably, one of the most impactful studies presented at ESMO was in renal cell carcinoma. Data from the JAVELIN Reno 101 trial show that the combination of avelumab and axitinib showed a doubling of objective response rate and significantly improved progression-free survival compared with sunitinib in patients with treatment-naive advanced RCC regardless of PD-L1 expression. We caught up with one of the JAVELIN Renal 101 authors, Tony Chueri, MD, director of the Link Center for Genitourinary Oncology and co-leader of the Kidney Cancer Center at Dana-Farber Cancer Institute in Harvard Medical School, to discuss the findings.
The initial phase 1 trial showed that the combination is tolerated at full dose of each agent, axitinib 5 milligram twice a day, and in addition, response rate were over 50%. 58%, to be correct. So moved directly to a phase 3 trial, and actually the primary endpoint was in PD-L1 positive patient, and it was met, 13.8 months versus 7.2 months. And in addition, when we looked at the overall population, which was a secondary endpoint, again, that was met. Response rate, whether you look at investigator assessment or an independent review, was also met. Another important secondary endpoint for which we do not have yet the event is overall survival. That's a very important endpoint, especially that with frontline therapies, the combo of nivolumab and ipilimumab, IO-IO, met one of the primary endpoint of overall survival. And especially that there was a press release 2 days before ESMO showing that a combination of axitinib, so the same drug, the same VEGF TKI, plus the PD-1 inhibitor pembrolizumab, met both progression-free survival and overall survival at the first interim analysis. So hopefully axitinib plus avelumab combination will be there soon. Interesting about this study is that when you look at the different risk group, patients seem to benefit irrespective of the risk group.
In breast cancer, there were two notable studies presented at this year's meeting. First was the phase 3 IMpassion 130 trial. In this trial, the addition of atezolizumab to nab-paclitaxel reduced the risk of progression or death by 38% compared with nab-paclitaxel alone in patients with PD-L1 positive metastatic triple-negative breast cancer. This is the first phase 3 trial to demonstrate a benefit with first-line immunotherapy in this breast cancer subtype. Also presented during the breast cancer session were the results of the SOLAR-1 trial. In this trial, the addition of the PI3K inhibitor alpelisib to fulvestrant nearly doubled median progression-free survival compared with endocrine therapy alone in patients with hormone receptor-positive, HER2-negative advanced breast cancer with PI3CA mutation. These study findings are expected to open the door for genomic testing in the malignancy, according to the lead study author, Fabrice André, MD, PhD. We sat down with Dr. André, a professor of medical oncology at the Institut Gustave Roussy, to discuss his takeaways from the SOLAR-1 trial results.
The patients were eligible if they were postmenopausal women or men who have an HR-positive, HER2-negative metastatic breast cancer, who previously received aromatase inhibitor, and for which there is a PIK3CA status available. And then there are two different cohorts. The first cohort are patients with PIK3CA mutation, and the second cohort are patients without the mutation. And these patients are randomized between fulvestrant plus placebo versus fulvestrant plus alpelisib. And the primary endpoint is progression-free survival in patients with a mutation. So the hypothesis is really on the patient with mutation. So what are the data telling us? So the trial showed that in the group of patients with PIK3CA mutation, there is an improvement of progression-free survival. The median PFS in the control arm is 5 months, and in the alpelisib arm, the median PFS is 11 months, and the hazard ratio is 0.65, with a p-value below the predefined threshold. So that is for the patient with mutation. In patient without mutation, there is no signal of efficacy confirming that the PIK3CA determination is mandatory if we want to identify the sensitive patients. In terms of safety profile, the drug has two main toxicity. One is hyperglycemia, with 36% of patients presenting a grade 3-4 hyperglycemia. And the second one is a rash. We have 10% of patients presenting a grade 3 rash.
According to interim findings from the phase 3 KEYNOTE-048 trial in recurrent or metastatic head and neck squamous cell carcinoma, frontline pembrolizumab monotherapy showed an improvement in overall survival and duration of response versus standard therapy in patients with PD-L1 positive tumors. Moreover, pembrolizumab in combination with chemotherapy was associated with a significant improvement in OS versus the standard regimen in the overall study population. However, there was not a similar improvement in progression-free survival or overall response rate with the PD-1 inhibitor. To explain these findings, lead author Barbara Burtness, MD, Professor of Medicine and Disease Aligned Research Team Leader of the Head and Neck Cancer Program at Yale Cancer Center, spoke with us at ESMO 2018.
So we know that immunotherapy has activity in head and neck cancer, and both pembrolizumab and nivolumab have been approved because of survival advantage in the second line setting. And so the question was, could you use immunotherapy, could you use a PD-1 inhibitor in the first line treatment? Partly because that's where it'd be likely to have the biggest impact on survival, and partly because many patients with head and neck cancer are quite sick and are not always fit for second line therapy. And so the other thing is that we know that if you look at which patients are most likely to respond from immunotherapy, being a high PD-L1 expressor in the tumor microenvironment, has been predictive of response. So this trial, which looked at the first line use of pembrolizumab, sort of asked two questions. The first was, would pembrolizumab alone be superior in those patients who had the biomarker profile that was associated with being pretty responsive to it? And the second was, given that chemotherapy is beneficial in head and neck cancer and that it leads to rapid disease control for patients who can be symptomatic, would there be an advantage to incorporating pembrolizumab directly with chemotherapy? So this was a phase 3 study that had 3 arms, and it compared pembrolizumab alone to a new regimen which took a platinating agent, either cisplatin or carboplatin, together with 5-FU, together with pembrolizumab. The chemotherapy was given for 6 cycles, and then the patients, if they were still progression-free, could continue on pembrolizumab alone. And the third arm was the extreme regimen, or old friend or foe, depending on how you perceive it. But so 6 cycles of a platinating agent, 5-FU, and cetuximab, followed by cetuximab alone. The patients were eligible who had squamous cell cancer. They couldn't have a curative intent local therapy. They had to have recurrent metastatic disease. They had to have tissue available so we could do the biomarker testing. And if they had an oropharynx cancer, we had to know their P16 status so we could stratify by that.
In April 2018, the FDA approved the combination of dabrafenib and trametinib for the adjuvant treatment of patients with BRAF V600E or V600K positive stage 3 melanoma following complete resection based on findings from the CombiAD trial. Long-term follow-up from the CombiAD trial presented at the 2018 ESMO Congress continued to show a significant relapse-free survival advantage for patients with resected stage 3 BRAF mutant melanoma treated with adjuvant dabrafenib plus trametinib. A Curie analysis for relapse-free survival produced estimates of 54% for dabrafenib plus trametinib and 37% for placebo, representing the proportion of patients expected to achieve long-term relapse-free survival. Jeffrey Weber, MD, Deputy Director and Co-Director of the Melanoma Program at NYU Langone's Perlmutter Cancer Center, sat down with us to discuss some of the biggest data with melanoma being presented at the Congress, including these promising results.
The exciting melanoma stuff was the 511 data, which was flip-dose ipi-nivo versus ipi-nivo, which clearly, to me, showed that it was just as good to flip the dose, reduce the toxicity by a solid third, instead of 48% grade 3-4 immune-related adverse events, 33, instead of a 33 or a 35% chance of stopping for toxicity, 25 or 26. So I think there's clearly major benefit in terms of toxicity to flipping the doses and lowering the dose of ipi. And I think the patients will do just as well. Do we have 5-year survival data? No. But I think the data looks so promising that I'd be very comfortable flipping the doses in new trials that I plan, especially of triple drug therapy. We'll hear KEYNOTE-022, we'll hear some COMBI data, that's the triple BRAF-MEK PD-1 data tomorrow. That'll be very important. We won't hear the phase 3 data, that's not coming for a year or two, but you know, it remains to be seen whether those triple regimens, which are very complex, toxic, and expensive, are better than a 2-drug regimen or just PD-1 alone. And then we'll hear the extended data on 067, 4-year survival data tomorrow. Those are important data.
In gastrointestinal cancer, one of the highlights was the durable activity demonstrated with the combination of the PD-L1 inhibitor atezolizumab and the VEGF inhibitor bevacizumab in patients with advanced hepatocellular carcinoma. In the trial, the confirmed investigator-assessed objective response rate was 32% per RECIST criteria, with more than half of responders maintaining their response for at least 6 months and about one-fourth for at least 12 months, said lead investigator Michael J. Pishvan, MD, PhD. We caught up with Dr. Pishvan for an interview where he reflected on these results.
So the trial was initiated, and I think we didn't expect to see such promising results. And for the first roughly 23 patients who were presented at ASCO on a poster, the response rate was above 60%. And what was more exciting was the durability of the responses. So the data was gathered and additional patients were enrolled. This presentation we had today was actually for 73 response evaluable patients. And while the response rate was lower, as often happens as more patients are collected, the reality is that the durability of the responses has been maintained. So for example, the overall response rate was 32%, but there were patients who had complete responses. And of the 23 patients who responded, 19 of them remain in response even at this point at the time of the data cutoff. So it looks like very promising, durable responses. So for the phase 1b, which is a multi-arm study, an atezolizumab alone arm was added, which will assess the contribution of atezolizumab by itself. But in parallel, concurrently, there's an ongoing phase 3 study comparing atezolizumab bevacizumab versus a reasonable first-line standard of care, sorafenib, for patients with first-line therapy for advanced metastatic HCC.
Coming off the excitement from the 19th World Conference on Lung Cancer, results in non-small cell lung cancer continued to impress the attendees at ESMO 2018. Edward Kim, chair of the Department of Solid Tumor Oncology at Levine Cancer Institute in Atrium Health, sat down with us to discuss his thoughts on the lung cancer data presented at the Congress.
ESMO has been a great meeting. I think this meeting has really emerged as an important meeting that has shown lots of new data or updates of existing data. It's been nice to see the updates with the IO therapies. I know that sounds very repetitive, but IO therapy has really transformed the field that I work in lung cancer. And so there's so much activity going on with new combinations. The session that I just presented in, there were two other atezolizumab abstracts that included combinations with chemotherapy, and the IMpower 130 data looked very compelling when you add atezolizumab with carboplatin and nab-paclitaxel. There's also been data about other markers here at ESMO, including the entrectinib data that has shown that TRK fusions with a different type of drug can also show benefit. And so we continue to get updates, even if it's durvalumab in stage 3 and other biomarkers that are being explored in lung cancer. It's very hard to keep up frankly, even for experts. But I really think it's a great discussion and great amount of data that's being contributed. We have a lot to sort out, but it seems like the momentum is continuing with positive trial after positive trial. And frankly, that's good for patients. We're giving them more choices. Clinicians have more choices now to treat patients. And it can be confusing, but I think that's a good position to be in. It's like sitting at dinner and trying to decide which one of these great entrees do you want to use or eat, as opposed to now in the clinic, we have multiple choices for patients. It will require more discussion. It will require more analysis of the data, and highlights the importance of trying to find biomarkers to help us stratify these patients into the right therapies. These days, it seems like there's a press release every other week about something in lung cancer. Some of it's good. Some of it is not so good. There are several regimens that are being under review, at least in the United States, that we may hear approvals on later this year or perhaps early next year. AACR is right around the corner, and I think we'll expect to see much more data that's being presented, as well as ASCO in the follow-up. So over the next 8 months or so, I think I don't see any slowdown to the amount of news that may come out, whether that would be about clinical trials succeeding or not, and biomarkers that are succeeding or not. But again, all of the noise, all of the news means that there's a lot of activity being done, and that's the good part, and that's the hopeful part about what's happening in lung cancer right now. I think as we attend meetings like ESMO, AACR, ASCO, World Lung, and all this great research is being presented, it's really important to understand that access to these trials by patients is really important. One of the sort of soapbox areas that I've had a stamp in the last few years has been eligibility criteria. I've had the pleasure of leading working groups combining with ASCO and Friends of Cancer Research, as well as regulatory bodies and industry and patient advocates, to try and establish some new eligibility criteria. We need to improve access for patients. It's very disheartening when an investigator identifies a trial, a patient is excited about a trial, and in fact they're not eligible due to some silly, antiquated eligibility criteria, whether that's based on creatinine, presence of brain metastases, a prior tumor they had that is non-threatening a few years ago. These are all not relevant to the modern precision medicine era that we're dealing with. So we've actually made a lot of headway. CTEP has recently changed their protocol templates to, in fact, include our recommendations, which have included these areas, as well as a minimum age of 12 years old. Why should a 12-year-old with sarcoma be excluded from a trial in which an 18-year-old is included? They metabolize drugs very similarly. HIV status, those patients who have HIV are living as long as the general population, and they're being excluded unnecessarily from clinical trials. It's really important to have a real-world population enrolled in these clinical trials, and I think we're gaining momentum, not just from regulatory agencies, but also from our partners in industry, our patient advocacy groups, and the clinicians.
That's all we have for today. Thank you for listening to the 15th episode of OncLive On Air. For more information on today's episode, please visit our ESMO conference page, which is accessible from the conference coverage tab on the OncLive homepage. Check back on Wednesdays for new interviews from the largest oncology conferences and our own State of the Science summits. For more updates on oncology, be sure to visit www.onclive.com and sign up for our e-newsletters. OncLive is also on social media. On Twitter, follow us at @OncLive and at @OncLiveSOSS. On Facebook, like us at OncLive and OncLive State of the Science Summit, and follow our OncLive page on LinkedIn. If you liked today's episode of OncLive On Air, please consider subscribing to our podcast on Apple Podcasts so that you get a notification every time a new episode is posted. While you're there, please take a moment to rate us. Thanks again for listening to OncLive On Air.